From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Good to be back with you again. More than 2.3 million people in Illinois are now fully vaccinated against COVID-19, according to numbers from the Illinois Department of Public Health. That has provided some hope that things could be returning to normal. And there's an idea that the little vaccine card you're given with a shot could even serve as a kind of a passport, opening up opportunities for travel, attending public events, and gathering with friends and family. Those sort of things have been off limits since the start of the pandemic more than a year ago. But what exactly changes once a person is double-dosed with the vaccine, or single-dosed in the case of the shot from Johnson & Johnson? And are there still inequities when it comes to just who has those privileges from being fully vaccinated? To talk about this, we're joined by Dr. Sadia Khan. She's a cardiologist at Northwestern Medicine and an assistant professor of preventative medicine and epidemiology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Khan, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Dr. William Parker, an assistant professor of medicine and pulmonary and critical care and assistant director of the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago. Dr. Parker, welcome to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation. The number is 800-222-9455. Have you been fully vaccinated, or are you on your way to that point? How are you feeling about socializing in person again once you are fully vaccinated? Do you have plans to travel or visit a loved one? Or maybe you just have questions in general for our guests about the vaccine. We'd love to hear from you. You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also always tweet us at 21st Show. Dr. Khan, I want to begin with you. So what changes for someone after they've received they're fully vaccinated, two doses of either the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine, or the one dose of the Johnson & Johnson?
That's a really great question, and really important to emphasize what a big change that is. One of my friends recently said to me that it feels like a new lease on life. And we have to emphasize that the data for the vaccine being effective at preventing not only contracting the virus, but almost nearly completely eliminating the odds of having a severe COVID-19 infection are tremendous. So a lot changes. I think that feeling of safety and security and getting closer to normalcy, although not yet normal, is important.
Can you remind us when after getting a vaccine you are considered quote unquote fully vaccinated?
Yeah, that's a great question. We know that about 2 weeks after the second dose is when we're considering that you're fully vaccinated. After the first dose, you have some of the antibodies and your body is likely ready to protect you for the most part, but it's not complete until 2 weeks after the second shot.
And I presume that applies just for the single shot vaccine as well from Johnson
&
Johnson.
Exactly, two weeks after.
Okay. I wonder if you can talk, Dr. Khan, a little bit about eligibility currently versus how many people are actually taking the opportunity to get vaccinated, if that makes sense.
Of course. And I'll throw in one other thing in there is access as well. So eligibility, opportunity, and then being able to navigate this very difficult system where are you getting it from your doctor? Are you getting it from the local pharmacy? Are you getting it from the health center at a mass vaccination center? So I think one of the biggest challenges, especially among older adults who maybe aren't tech savvy or know which websites to go to, has been this continued refrain of, I just don't even understand how to get my appointment.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. And navigating all these different websites. I've heard stories of people traveling to other cities, other counties even, because maybe they could get an appointment at a certain drugstore or something like that. Is this something that you've heard as well?
Absolutely. Or even across states for people who live in more than one state. And there are definitely places that are doing a faster job and have been able to open up eligibility to all adults compared with other places like in Illinois or Chicago, where it may still be harder if you're younger to get an appointment.
Dr. William Parker, can you talk a little bit about these mass vaccination sites? Are these the most effective ways to get the vaccine to people?
Well, I think they're an important tool to help bridge some of the vaccine equity gaps, you know, the two we were just discussing. I mean, the reason the city of Chicago lags behind the rest of the state is it has been proportionally under-allocated vaccines compared to many of the downstate counties. For example, Adams County has received per person a far greater proportion of vaccines than the city. And the reasons for this are complicated. There's a lot of what's called like vaccine exports, people who, you know, work at my medical center at the University of Chicago. I'm sure lots of Dr. Khan's colleagues at Northwestern work in the city, got their shot in the city, but actually live in the suburbs. Unfortunately, the allocations from the federal government hasn't reflected that. So the city of Chicago has a massive vaccine deficit, and that explains why the mayor has been hesitant to expand eligibility, because we have so many vulnerable people uncovered. Vaccination sites that are being placed strategically by FEMA in urban cities, urban areas which have tended to be under-allocated vaccines, are an important way to help bridge this gap and this divide.
And I remember reading that there was a big mass vaccination site set up at the United Center. And in fact, so many people were coming in from the suburbs as opposed to the surrounding neighborhoods where maybe the equity gap is greater, that the city sort of restricted eligibility to that. Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's what happened initially. So I'm not exactly sure how the politics all played out, but they opened it statewide to everyone over 65. At a time when, this is back earlier in phase 1B, when the mass vaccination site opened up, at a time when this same vaccine gap between the city and the rest of the state existed. And, you know, in order to sign up, you had to go on to ZocDoc.com, you know, navigate through several websites in order to register. And you also had to know that the mass vaccination site was available and that information had to be disseminated to your community. So that digital divide created a very predictable disparity where people who were more well-resourced and wealthy were able to come in from outside the city and book appointments. So after that, the FEMA, and you know, I'm not exactly, again, sure who made the call, but they restricted geographically who can receive vaccinations at a mass vaccination site to people who live in the city.
Right.
And that's still the case, is my understanding. But you know, that isn't quite enough, actually, just slapping a geographic restriction on to achieve vaccine equity. There's a lot more we could be doing. One example, comparing to the UK, is this idea of automatic registration or pre-registration and active outreach. So in the UK, when it's time for you to get your vaccine appointment, the NHS calls you because they have a list of everyone. They know who's eligible, and they just call them. And then people come in for their vaccine appointment. Switching to that sort of system, where using whatever existing lists that the city can come up with and reaching out actively to people by phone and text message, and then if they don't respond to that, door to door, is the way we're gonna reach the most vulnerable populations in the city and across the state.
Wow, fascinating approach. All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce my guests. If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about how life might change for us after the COVID vaccine. A lot more people are getting vaccinated. The latest numbers, I think, from the State Department of Public Health are that 2.3 million people in Illinois are now fully vaccinated. We're speaking with, as you just heard there, Dr. William Parker, who's an assistant professor of medicine and pulmonary and critical care, and also assistant director of the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago. Also, Dr. Sadia Khan, who is a cardiologist at Northwestern Medicine and an assistant professor of preventative medicine and epidemiology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 800-222-9455. And I'm going to go now to line four. Larry is on the line from Springfield. Larry, thanks for calling in.
Well, thanks for having me.
I understand you have some travel plans. You're fully vaccinated now?
Yeah, I'm fully vaccinated. Got both my shots. Got the last one about 2 weeks ago. Had, you know, somewhat of some adverse effects, but I kind of expected it just based on what I've been hearing from friends and what I've been reading. But for the month of July, I'm booked up for the month of July already. I'm going to Alabama for a friend's birthday. I'm going to Puerto Rico for another friend's birthday and Miami for another friend's birthday. So me and all our friends, we're kind of working together to make sure we're all vaccinated so we can all enjoy ourselves. And really, to be honest with you, I've been traveling throughout the pandemic, just, you know, being safe, make sure I, you know, wore my mask and wash my hands and, you know, just taking the proper medical precautions that have been suggested, quarantining when necessary. And it's been, you know, you have to take advantage of these cheap flight prices as while you could, and the cheap hotels while you could too, because you never know, like that this is like a once in a lifetime event. So it definitely created some space, and definitely looking forward to the world opening back up.
All right, Larry, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Dr. Khan, I wonder if you want to weigh in on any of that or just talk about travel in general. Should people be following that lead? And if you are fully vaccinated and can travel with a group that's fully vaccinated, is it okay to travel and make plans, especially for later this year?
Absolutely. It's a really important part of why we want people to be vaccinated, so that we can return to some of these normal activities. One of the things that Larry mentioned is that taking precautions is still important. So when you're out and about and traveling, because we know that not everybody has gotten the vaccine, so you're going to be in a crowded airport or on a plane with others who have not gotten the vaccine and are not vaccinated, it's important to continue to use those precautions, such as masking, hand washing, the same way as before. But I think it opens up some possibility to do this safely.
What about, Dr. Khan, with a family, right? Kids are still not eligible for the vaccine. There's some thought that teenagers maybe by the midsummer, end of the summer, could start getting vaccinated. But younger children, they're still testing the efficacy and safety, I gather, of the disease in the youngest members of our society. How should a family think about travel?
That's a great question. And I think similar precautions, if in place, if your child is old enough to wear a mask and mask consistently, then can be undertaken in a family or group. It's a little bit of a risk-benefit evaluation. So we all know that life isn't risk-free. So we have to assess and weigh the risks and benefits of what is needed. So if there is a trip or travel that is important, and I think we all have been cooped up for very long, that we want to make sure that we're also paying attention to mental health needs and how we need to be able to enjoy ourselves. So doing everything with caution and with precautions in place, I think, is possible.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Demetria is on the line from Rochelle. Demetria on line one, thanks for calling in.
Yes. My question is like, I have a younger child who is under the age of vaccination, but yet the whole family has been fully vaccinated or being fully vaccinated. So again, with younger children, she has pulmonary stenosis. And so we're not even sure if they could even get vaccinated because we don't know the components of the vaccination. So with regards to those younger children, how will that vaccine affect them when they have medical conditions such as that, like my child with pulmonary stenosis?
Okay, Demetria, thanks for calling in. Dr. Parker, do you have a perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a little bit more in Dr. Khan's wheelhouse, but I'm a pulmonary critical care physician and spent a lot of the pandemic taking care of very sick, you know, adults with COVID-19. And, you know, fortunately, this disease really is a disease of the elderly and older people, and for younger children, that is. And so I think, you know, the relative risk of any child, even those with chronic conditions of getting severely ill with COVID-19 is incredibly small. So that's played into policies, you know, across the country, and the way that the vaccine rollout has gone on. And I think from an ethical perspective, that makes sense.
And Dr. Khan, if this is in your wheelhouse, we have about 30 seconds before we need to take a break, but I wonder if you have anything to add on that caller.
Yeah, it's a great point about whether or not the vaccine is safe for those with chronic conditions. And one of the things that we've noticed that's so important about COVID is that the severity of infection is worse in those with chronic conditions. And as Dr. Parker mentioned, especially in adults, we've seen this, and less so in children. but yet the vaccine is safe and effective across a broad range of ages and conditions that has been tested so far. So I wouldn't have any concern in children with chronic conditions once it's safe in children to proceed with vaccination.
Okay. And we do have one other caller on the line. I'm going to ask you to hang on. We'll get to your question after a break. That is also about the safety of the vaccine. And we're going to continue talking about that, as well as the idea of vaccine passports, the idea that you might have to prove you've been vaccinated in order to access mass public events, getting on an airplane, traveling to another country. That and more is going to come up after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. More to come. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're continuing our conversation about the COVID vaccines and how safe, or I should say, what you should be able to do, what you might, precautions you might still want to take, but where opportunities for somewhat of a return to normal life might be opening up for people who've taken the vaccine. We're having this conversation with Dr. Sadia Khan, who is a cardiologist and on the faculty at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Also, Dr. William Parker, who's assistant professor of medicine and assistant director of the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago. And I want to take one more call here on the question of vaccine safety. And Bob is on the line, called in at 800-222-9455. Bob in Peoria, thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Yes. About 10 years ago, I had Guillain-Barré syndrome and was paralyzed and have recovered, but I was told to never take a live virus vaccine. And I know the two COVID vaccines available to us are mRNA-based, but that I need to be careful. And I'm wondering, have you got any advice for people who have been warned because of Guillain-Barré to be careful about vaccines?
Okay, thanks for the question, Bob. Dr. Khan, I wonder if you have a perspective on that, and maybe you can talk a little bit about what the composition of the vaccines that we're currently talking about is.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm sorry, and that must have been so scary with the prior episode with Guillain-Barré syndrome, which of course can be quite scary. The advantage to the current vaccines that we're discussing, like was noted, is that these are not live viruses. With the mRNA, or using the building blocks of a protein on the virus, these vaccines have not shown any association with Guillain-Barré syndrome. And we feel very comfortable and confident in saying that even individuals who have had a prior history of a Guillain-Barré syndrome reaction are safe to receive the vaccine. And with as many people as have now gotten the vaccine without observing a surge or increase in Guillain-Barré syndrome cases across the world, that's very reassuring as well.
Dr. Parker, we have another guest I'm going to bring in just a moment. But before we do, I want to ask about this idea of a vaccine passport. You know what? Let me strike that. I'm going to bring our guest in now. Alexis Hancock joins us. She is director of engineering at CertBot and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Her latest research focuses on digital rights and our digital identities in the age of COVID-19. Alexis Hancock, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So let me begin with you about this idea of vaccine passports. We've been hearing about this idea that maybe you would need this to, you know, depending on how broadly or narrowly it's construed, to get on an airplane, to attend public events. But, you know, some people are are holding out the prospect that maybe you would even need it just to go into a restaurant or something like that. Where do you see this idea going?
Well, what we're very worried about is the scope creep that you just mentioned, that right now we have a precursor, right, for presenting vaccine proof. Usually around international travel when you have a yellow card, and that is
if you've been vaccinated for yellow fever.
Yes, this is for yellow fever vaccine in particular, and you are issued something by the WHO or the World Health Organization, a piece of paper for international travel, right? So there's some precursor there, but what we're worried about is these new proposals that are kind of outside of that, expanding it to, you know, sports venues, restaurants, possibly public health services, libraries, things of that nature. And so that scope creep worries us, especially since this is not something that's issued by the WHO. These are private companies providing solutions to other private companies. So that means the digital data that's within their system, as you present your vaccine information to them, won't be covered under the usual medical privacy conditions that we normally have with our doctor, like HIPAA. So that is the privacy law that is for our medical data. But since that steps outside of that, we're worried about that. We're worried about the context it's being used in, and we don't want it exacerbating current inequities. A lot of the solutions we have seen are digital. So we are really worried about tech literacy and tech equity and providing a solution for people to go forward and be able to actually, you know, enter this equitably instead of creating another barrier for people.
Dr. Parker, can you weigh in on that? I mean, as you work in the field of medical ethics, what do you think about this idea of a vaccine passport?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of focus on it, which sort of envisions this dystopian world where COVID is still present, lots of people are refusing vaccinations, there's still a high degree of hospitalization and deaths, kind of like what we're dealing with now. I guess I'm just a little bit more optimistic where we're going to reach herd immunity and sort of make COVID not a big issue in people's daily lives and make this essentially irrelevant, except in the cases of international travel. So while I understand why it's sort of the topic du jour, as particularly a lot of the more well-connected and wealthy people in the country get vaccinated and they want to start making sure that they, you know, get their status symbol stamp of approval, I think the focus should be primarily on expanding vaccine access to our underserved and hardest hit communities across the country, where people desperately want the vaccine, but they can't figure out how to get it or cross the various digital divides and barriers we've set up, preventing people from getting doses.
And Dr. Khan, I wonder if you have a perspective on this idea of the vaccine passport.
Yeah, one of the most important parts about the passport is it implies that there's equitable access to the vaccine. And so like Alexis and Dr. Parker mentioned, we're not there yet. The other concern is how do we validate this? And I know some in the White House have suggested maybe the government should be doing this or creating a passport that can be verified, but it seems really challenging to introduce a whole new system to try to create this process when we know this is also the case for other vaccines that all of our children should be having and are required to have proof of through their pediatrician's office. So perhaps we can increase access and use some trust as well and get to herd immunity to really be the response here.
You know, Alexis, there's have been some colleges that have announced they're going to require proof of vaccinations for students for the fall semester, including Cornell and Rutgers and Roger Williams University. I don't know that we've seen any of that in Illinois in particular, but I mean, schools, universities in particular already require proof of certain vaccinations in order to attend school. Would this be any different in your view?
So vaccine proof itself is something that we're not exactly against in context that's already established, like education, international travel. In those contexts, we hope that people are approaching that in a way that is ethical, right? As the doctors have said and spoke already about equitable access and the fact that we don't see this as a permanent solution, we don't think that vaccine passports should be something that should be invested in going forward. The particular context I'm talking about is seeing that these private apps come out and working with people to have like another solution and extra resources put towards that. So vaccine proof isn't the issue. It's the whole notion of the vaccine passport itself, right? So we're not there yet. We don't have a lot of vaccine access just yet. Certain age groups aren't able to get this vaccine yet, under 16. We haven't seen people that in other countries haven't even have been able to access the COVID vaccine yet. So we don't want to exacerbate this divide already with a separate solution called a vaccine passport. We don't want this coming into the ecosystem and creating more vaccine hesitance because they'll have to store their information with a private company, especially the medical information. We don't want to have that actually beginning to be counterproductive to the whole notion of we're all in this together, right? So we don't want to create permanent experimental solutions that are outside of the scope of what we already do with our health information in the first place. We want to have actually going forward just temporary measures, and then what happens with these vaccine passports after they get established? Hopefully they won't wide scale with digital vaccine passports. And a lot of the solutions that we have seen that from people proposal have not actually explained. So when this is over, what happens with people's data? Will you get rid of it? Will you delete it? Will you propose to do something else? We don't know what their plans are for the future for these digital vaccine passports. So as far as vaccine proof goes with like your institution, we have seen that handled different ways. But as far as the digital vaccine passport itself, this is something that we don't want to see this experimental technology going forward. The last place I want to see experimental technology is a pandemic.
Dr. Parker, I wonder if you can address this concern about possibly handing over health information to a private company, right? Patient privacy is something that a lot of people are concerned about. There's the big federal health care privacy law known as HIPAA. I mean, would this potentially be, if you are required to disclose to someone whether or not you're vaccinated, is that a potential breach of that? Maybe you can just talk about that in general.
Well, I guess I'm okay from that perspective with incentives for vaccination. That maybe if you want to go to sporting events and then a private business is setting up vaccination as a precondition for that to keep its clientele safe. I don't know that obviously can create equity and access issues. And this again would be assuming where it's in the summer, everyone who wants a vaccine has been offered one via active outreach, so a couple months down the line. But I really do think, at that point, then this issue kind of will be largely irrelevant once we've hit herd immunity. And we really should be spending all of our time and effort focusing on getting to that threshold. And I do, I share the same concerns about these private companies popping up with no state government certification their actions, claiming they have vaccine passports. I have no idea how that would actually work in practice. I mean, I get vaccinated at University of Chicago. I think I already lost my little card, right? I mean, that record is presumably in their system, but the practical barriers here seem so enormous, and the potential to exacerbate disparities seem to outweigh any potential public health benefits.
And Dr. Khan, I wonder what your view is. We've seen Governor J.B. Pritzker here in Illinois has said that he is open to the idea of this passport. But, other governors in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis there signed an executive order banning COVID passports because he says it would interfere with the flow of business. I wonder if a private enterprise wanted to say, like, if Disney, for example, come to our park, you have to be vaccinated. That's sort of a way of reassuring customers. Some people might not want to go unless they had that reassurance. How do you weigh that against the concerns about, potentially giving up your private health information to some third party?
I think as Alexis really eloquently outlined, we don't know what's going to happen to that information after the fact. And so that should be of concern. But beyond the concern about your private information and where that would go, I think the bigger question of requiring a vaccine passport for participating, even in a private corporation like Disney, sets the precedent that you have to be able to have access to something that you may not have yet had access to. And so creating different tiers of what people can do, I think, is problematic.
For the reasons of equity, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah. Alexis, maybe we can close with you. I wonder if, you know, there are already things that you have to have a driver's license in order to be able to operate a motor vehicle. Do you draw a distinction between things like that, where the government has already imposed restrictions and criteria and requirements on people, and you have to take a test, for example, in order to get that driver's license, and, you know, sort of a COVID vaccine proof in order to things? And is there a distinction to be drawn between, say, maybe you wouldn't want that proof of vaccination required to do something like voting, which is a fundamental constitutional right, versus getting on an airplane, which no one really, I don't think, has a constitutional right to travel by air, for example?
Yes, I think that's a good place to start with when we're talking about digital IDs versus IDs have been established via documentation from the government. So the ongoing worry that we have is a precursor to a national ID or a national ID database. We don't want to create precursors for that in particular and consolidation of that. So you have your driver's licenses, you have, you know, insurance cards, you have different documentation that you already kind of have to your identity, right? But a digital vaccine passport wouldn't be issued by any authority in particular. It would be something that you would entrust to a private company, and that wouldn't be something that would be oversight by anyone. So it's really just leaving it up to the word of the companies themselves. The only state so far I've seen roll out a digital vaccine passport is New York, and they're working with IBM to do that. So there's other solutions that I have seen, like Common Pass and everyone else, but I haven't seen anyone that actually has any oversight. It's all just really taking their word for it. We have established certain checks and balances with government in our IDs already. We've had different battles in the past with like real ID, because that was a worry in the past and still is a worry as far as setting a precursor to national identification. So we don't want to create more consolidation of that by creating yet a new system. And since the situation we would all hope would be temporary, and let's say next year we do have more vaccines, I definitely think we should put all our resources to that in particular, get everyone vaccinated, get people out there, have people, you know, not have a reason to have more vaccine hesitance because they would have to get some sort of digital pass in order to move on to the next step. I think we should dedicate resources for that. Right now, I think digital vaccine passport solutions are a waste of time and money.
All right, and we're going to have to leave it there. Alexis Hancock is with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've also been speaking with Dr. William Parker from the University of Chicago and Dr. Sadia Khan from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Thank you all so much for being here today on the 21st. More to come after a short break. Stay with us.
Support for the 21st comes from Christie Clinic. Christie Clinic, providing health care to the community for more than 90 years. Local procedures, providers, specialties, and choice. Christie Clinic is focused on caring for the community.